You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. According to historians, it's probably been 90 years since the first Japanese animated film hit the screens. Coinciding with this, the Barbican Cinema in London has been running a season of films that celebrate the best of recent anime from both the big screen and small. Tonight, I'm talking to the curator of the season, Helen McCarthy, who has written a variety of books on the subject, about why she chose certain films to be shown and which are her favourite examples of the genre.
How did it come about, this mini-season of anime that you've curated?
Well, it's really been an awfully long time in coming, because the Barbican's been championing Japanese animation along with all sorts of odd little nooks and crannies of world cinema for getting on for 25 years now. They've been showing anime at the Barbican off and on for quite some time. And in 1991, they had a particularly interesting showing of the work of Hayao Miyazaki for the Japan Festival. Now, of course, now everybody knows Miyazaki's name. He's the Oscar winner who's revolutionized animation, made the West look again at what anime is all about. But back then, he was an obscure guy who couldn't be pronounced by most film critics. So the Barbican really kind of got hold of anime and championed it. I got involved with them very early on, working with the Children's Film Club and with what has now become the London Children's Film Festival, which used to be School Film Week. They were looking for somebody to talk about film to 5 to 7 year olds, and I really enjoy working with very young children because they have such an honest, refreshing way of reacting to film and of reacting to ideas and taking them and running with them. So we had a lot of fun with that, and when the Barbican team said to me that they were kind of open to the idea of doing similar work but with slightly older audiences, I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do a season that drew links between anime and the world visual culture that it's very much a part of?
Right. I mean, gosh, if they started showing Miyazaki films in 91, that really is ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people in this country didn't hear of him until Spirited Away came out.
That's it. The ICA was just a fraction ahead of them in doing screenings. The ICA did some screenings slightly earlier, but in terms of actually getting behind them and championing the films and championing the less well-known directors, the Barbican is definitely up there at the beginning.
I mean, thinking back at what the world was like back in 91, as far as most people were concerned, I suppose most anime, if indeed people use that term, I suppose people used manga back then interchangeably, it was Akira and pretty much little else.
Well, in fact, the term manga became very much the vogue term purely because of a brilliant marketing campaign by a guy called Andy Frayne, who used to head up Island World Communications video arm, which became Manga Video. And he obviously decided that it would be very good for his company and their sales for the term manga to be synonymous with the whole of Japanese animation. And he ran one of the best campaigns I've ever seen to position it in the kind of 13 to 16 demographic for young males as a cutting-edge, cyberpunk, violent, aggressive mode. And, you know, brilliantly done, but unfortunately it had a really negative effect. And what interested me at the time, as someone who got involved in it and started researching it, is that up until the early 90s, all the writing that you get about anime, and there's not much of it, is in terms of it's those big-eyed Saturday morning cartoons, children's packs like Speed Racer, like Kimba the White Lion. It's nothing to write home about. It's just cheap entertainment for kids. And almost overnight, when the video boom started in Britain after Akira, it becomes this thick snuff cartoon, as The Independent famously described it.
I mean, it's ironic, actually, that the two examples that you just gave, Kimba the White Lion would then go on to be a major influence on The Lion King. And
although, don't let Disney hear you say that.
Okay. and now, apparently, the Wachowski brothers are doing Speed Racer as a live-action film.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, quite seriously, Disney specifically issued a statement to the effect that nobody involved with The Lion King had ever seen any of Tezuka's great series Jungle Emperor, which became Kimba the White Lion in the States, which is pretty silly, because not only had Matthew Broderick, who voiced Simba, actually said, when I went for the part, I thought I was reading for Kimba, a white lion in a cartoon when I was a kid, but quite a number of the crew had worked with various Japanese creatives and were bound to know the work of Osamu Tezuka, even if they hadn't specifically sat and watched Kimba's Children. But Disney were very, very concerned that they shouldn't be seen as plagiarizing, that they should be seen as creating something wholly original. And it's sort of sad, because one of the wonderful things about anime, and one of the wonderful things particularly about Osamu Tezuka, who was one of the great authentic geniuses of the 20th century, is that it doesn't plagiarize, it takes influences and recycles them in the same way that all artists do. That there is very, very little wholly original thought in the world. What wholly original thought there is largely met with incomprehension, because it is wholly original, and it takes a while for ideas to be digested and filtered. And what anime does really brilliantly as a popular culture form is it takes elements from all over the world, all over high culture, all over low culture, all over zero culture, all over street life, and it regurgitates them into something new. But sadly, with The Lion King and later coming the other way with the Atlantis movie, didn't seem able to see it as a positive to say, well, yes, there was a fabulous series back in the 60s, and we really know our animation, so we recognize that there were things in this series that we could use and bring to a new audience. And what could have been a really joyous, energetic, affirmative celebration of artists taking influences from each other all over the world became instead a fairly nasty and ungracious little spat that upset animation fans and didn't really have any gain for anybody.
Well, and it seems particularly ironic that the Disney cartoons that most people think of as classics are adaptations of timeless fairy tales and children's novels.
Well, absolutely, and Disney have been able to bring something to those fairy tales and novels that no other reversioner has done. Mm. You can't say that Sleeping Beauty, for example, is less of a tribute to Perrault than La Belle et la Bête, that Disney's Cinderella is less than a ballet version of Cinderella. They're all just different approaches. And so it does seem to me absolutely absurd to get defensive about originality.
And also, I mean, to bring the story right up to date, in recent years, Disney handled the distribution of Miyazaki's back catalogue in America to the extent that they almost seemed to be trying to keep them as a niche, that they wouldn't gain a wider audience. Or is that just conspiracy theory on my part?
There's been a lot of speculation and rumour around that, but I think one has to be fair to Disney, one has to look at the economics of putting a film on 6,000, 7,000 screens right through the States. You need an awful lot of prints, you need an awfully big investment. And if you're not absolutely convinced that the money is going to come back, it may pay better to say we're going to position this in a niche and have a success for a niche, and therefore not involve a director that we've come to respect in losing faith, and not involve us in losing money, rather than try and roll out 6,000 screens all across the States and have it bomb in the multiplexes. So, you know, there are ways of looking at it from both sides, and I know that anime fandom has felt very strongly that Disney didn't get behind the early Miyazaki releases as well as they could. But I think Disney has a story to tell there as well, and in fairness, I don't know if the market was ready for the kind of coverage on, say, Princess Mononoke that they later became ready for on Spirited Away.
Mm.
In fact, of course, in my view, the one real mistake that Disney has made, which I still find it impossible to comprehend, is that they didn't carpet bomb the market with Cuddly Totoros as soon as the opportunity opened up.
Considering that all of his back catalogue came out on Disney DVD for a while in America, you think they'd have done all sorts of merchandising tie-ins, knowing what Disney are like.
Well, my understanding is, from certainly I don't think it's changed since I interviewed Toshio Suzuki, Miyazaki's producer, way back in 1997 when I was writing my book about him. Suzuki said then that they had not signed a merchandising deal with Disney because Studio Ghibli wanted to keep control of merchandising themselves. He said, we've built up a long relationship with the companies that work with us. We trust them, and they've gone a long way to support us and help us. We don't want to give away control of the quality of our merchandise or the style of our merchandise to any partner, no matter how, you know, intelligent or powerful or good at marketing they are. So, in fact, it's not that Disney don't want to merchandise, it's that Disney don't have the right to merchandise. And when you think about it, you've got a studio, a little tiny studio in Tokyo that has 100 people there, and that has the balls to say no to Disney. You've really got to respect that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just a shame that the new Studio Ghibli film, Tales of Earthsea, is apparently going to be delayed over here for a couple of years because of problems with a live-action adaptation.
It may not be delayed over here. The last that I heard was that they were looking into what rights had been surrendered by Ursula Le Guin in terms of UK sales, because, as you know, the live-action adaptation has been screened on American TV.
Right.
And come out in DVD over there, but not over here. So my understanding is that there might be a possibility that a British release could come ahead of an American release. But, of course, again, it's whether Disney would consider that economically viable and good marketing, even if it's legally possible. It may be preferable in terms of their big picture to do the US and the British release together.
Do you think the kind of audiences that anime gets in Britain are different to the kind they get in America?
I don't think they're different in type. I think they're different in degree. In scale, sorry. We're not seeing the huge responses we've seen in America. I mean, for example, every year I go to Dallas and I deliver a series of talks and lectures at a convention called Project ACON, which is a little local convention. Well, now it's a big local convention. But in America, a little local convention is 3,000 to 5,000 people. In Britain, an enormous major convention is 1,200 people. ACON now pulls 11,000 to 12,000 a year. I don't think there's a single science fiction event that's ever done that in Britain. So you're just talking about a much bigger market. And because you're talking about a bigger market, it can cater more broadly. For example, at an average American convention or screening, you'll see a number of fans in wheelchairs. You'll see a number of fans with disabilities. You'll see a very wide racial range. You'll see a very wide age range. In Britain, this is much less common. But hopefully, as the market matures, and as it happens now, fans who were in that first wave, fans who were in their 20s and came to see the Miyazakis at the Barbican in 1991, are now taking their kids, and in one or two cases, their grandchildren. So gradually, you do see fandom broadening out.
Obviously, when an anime film gets a wide release in this country, it's generally going to be the dubbed version. When you help out with screenings at the Barbican, I imagine it's the subtitled one.
Yeah, we usually show subtitles at the Barbican because that's what our specific audience has told us they want.
Right.
But as you know, very few large cinemas can afford to be snobbish about what type of thing they screen. They screen what the audience demands. If they have a choice, they will generally go for dub because that's what a mass audience wants. And for example, when I'm working with small children, there is no point showing a subtitled print to small children.
Yeah.
They're just not going to follow it. You're better off actually showing them the raw language cut with no reading to worry about. And then you find that if the filmmaker knows what they're doing in terms of storytelling, little children will follow. I mean, I have shown Totoro to three-year-olds, British three-year-olds. And they can generally give you a fairly good idea of the story at the end of the film. The majority of them are actually held for 90 minutes, which is a great tribute to Miyazaki's ability to tell a story in pictures.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was thinking, actually, on children's television on the BBC, there are various international imports like Pokoyo and Pingu, where the characters just talk gibberish, you know, and obviously they have a regular audience.
When you think about it, little children really aren't very, very rigid about language anyway. Mm. They make whatever sounds seem to them to be appropriate, and they're much better than older people are at closely following the non-linguistic cues and picking up meaning from context, which is exactly what you have to do with a foreign language film. So in a sense, maybe all our major newspapers would be better off getting very small children as foreign language film critics.
You may be right. When it comes to older children, though, with these screenings at the Barbican, do you find that they're receptive to the subtitle print?
We don't have so many people that I would describe as children in the evening screenings at the Barbican. Most of our audiences are, I would say, 15, 16 plus. So teenagers going into college years. And then over that, they tend to move up quite rapidly. We've had a number of people in the audience who I'm quite sure are retired. So it's a very wide range there. But older children tend to move in two waves. The ones who are Japanophiles and who are really into the idea of anime's origin as something cool and unique tend to be very dismissive about dubs. While the ones who are gaming fans and who play computer games and perhaps are more into following the action of the story are more accepting of dubs. But in fact, since all anime is dubbed anyway, all animation is dubbed anyway, I've never really understood the big deal. For me, it's much more important to have a solid translation and good performances if you're working with a dub than it is to say dubs are absolutely wrong and subtitles are the only way to go. I mean, the big loss, obviously, is the original performance if you move to a dub. But then if you get a really great actor they can give a good performance. It's not the original performance, but it's a great version. Of course, in Japan, most Western films are dubbed, and a number of very well-known anime actors have made solid reputations for themselves playing Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie or Natalie Portman or various other Western luminaries, and their voices are as well-known in Japan as any of their Western counterparts.
Mm. The four films, or rather three films and TV series that you chose to show at the Barbican, Perfect Blue, Totoro, the first few episodes of Samurai 7, and Paprika. Apart from the fact that presumably Paprika is going to be getting a wide release in the not-too-distant future, what made you choose those four in particular?
Well, we talked about what we wanted to do when we were looking at setting up this first season, and we've gone on to extend it into July now with several more films.
Okay, cool.
And what I really wanted was to take some films that I thought deserved more exposure and put a slightly different context on them, give the audience a different way of coming at them. So with Perfect Blue, for example, we looked at it after doing some thinking about and looking at clips from Hitchcock's Vertigo and David Fincher's Seven.
Right.
Con's been very upfront about the influences of Hitchcock and of many other Western filmmakers on his work, and he's an enormously literate filmmaker in filmic terms. His field of reference is very wide. That's something he has in common with Miyazaki, and I think it's one thing that makes them really great directors and lifts them out of the herd, that they really inhabit the world of film as opposed to just the world of Japanese animation. Their frame of reference is very broad and very humane. And stage fright is often talked of in terms of influence on Perfect Blue. But I wanted to have a little look at Vertigo because I've got a personal relationship with Vertigo that is extremely difficult. It fascinates me as a film. It's beautiful. I mean, it's stunningly done. Brilliantly played. Casting Jimmy Stewart against a type, of course, has got to be one of the great decisions of all time. Fantastically designed, that wonderful saturated colour, and the city as a character, the city as a malevolent, brooding presence is so well portrayed. But I really don't like Vertigo.
Okay.
I think it's Alexander Walker once described it as one of the great romances of all time, and I think it's one of the great films about violence against women of all time. Vertigo is centred on the deification of an abusive relationship and the utter selfishness and self-absorption of an unhinged man and how it destroys women. So for me, Vertigo is always kind of a difficult call. And Con's film is so humane and so affirmative about women and so positive, even about deeply damaged women like the lady who finally turns out to be the villain, that I thought it's very interesting to look at how those two work together and what Con has taken from this vicious masterpiece of Hitchcock's to put into his own film and how he's transmuted it to make it the warm, humane film that I love. And of course, Seven is an incredibly bleak, really harrowing film where you've got a man struggling to maintain his humanity against a world that's just not interested in it. And again, the contrast there was very interesting. So I thought it would be quite fun to look at that with the audience and just give people some thoughts to take away and some ideas to extend on. And we had a really lively discussion afterwards, which was very, very enjoyable and really energizing and made me think, gosh, this is going to be fun for the rest of the series. Then, of course, with Totoro, it was an opportunity to look at how Studio Ghibli's circle of influence had changed and grown in the years between Totoro being made and now, where Miyazaki is a major world filmmaker recognized throughout the English-speaking world. Because Ghibli's circle of influence works two ways. Obviously, Ghibli is kind of the stone that's been dropped into the pool of world animation, and it doesn't appear to have changed much, but its ripples are spreading outwards and hitting other studios all over the world. It's punched way above its weight in terms of influence. So that was fun to talk to an audience about. And really, it's just picking up little snippets from here and there and saying, let's look at this in a slightly different way. Let's think about this in another way. Seven Samurai, of course. Seven Samurai was a wonderful opportunity to look at one of the great defining moments of Japanese post-war cinema and a TV series in a highly successful medium in a totally different world, made for a totally different audience, in a Japan that's changed, in a way, in a Japan that's changed far more than Kurosawa's Japan had changed since the time of the samurai.
Right.
And that was really interesting. And one of the audience at the end gave me a wonderful key to develop that a little further, because he said, you haven't talked about Magnificent Seven. Where are we going to go with that? So, I came home and started writing notes thinking, yeah, this is great, we can go somewhere with this. It's just such a lot of fun to be able to talk about film to other people who are crazy about film, and you can see that they're crazy about film because they bothered to turn out and pay money on a Tuesday night to hear me talk about anime. It's just the most wonderful opportunity to explore some interesting ideas and hopefully to encourage people to go away and start thinking along their own line. Because one of the great things about an experience like getting together in front of a big screen to watch a really wonderful movie, the way it was intended to be seen, is that you're sharing it. I mean, now that we can all download movies onto all sorts of devices, we're moving onto handhelds and PDAs, movies are becoming less and less a shared experience. And when you think of their power to move and to frustrate and to annoy and to transcend, I think those are all emotions that should be shared, that are valuable shared. And so it's to me, it's a wonderful thing to find anything that gets people out at night and into a cinema with others sharing an experience.
Going back to what you were saying about YouTube and internet sites, although it is obviously a very solitary experience, at the same time, it might be a good place for getting people into anime, because I came across Mind Game in installments on YouTube, and I probably would have never heard of this film otherwise. And having seen it in like a small box on a computer screen, I'd like to see it on a decent DVD copy now, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the more ways that you can get people to open up to new things, the better. And one of the wonderful things about YouTube and about any similar way of approaching it is that you can try snippets of new things. But my worry is that you can keep jumping from snippet to snippet. And I do worry that we're developing the attention span of gnats in terms of our culture. Mm. That we're starting to want something new every 5 minutes, where some films do demand that you put in quite a bit of time thinking about them and getting to the heart of them. But it's not until you've had the experience of the whole film that you realise that you need the variations in pace. It's like music. You can't have everything at the same tempo unless you're doped out of your brain. You need variations in pace, in tempo. Your brain needs to absorb things at different rates. That's something else that people over here aren't so aware of yet, but in Japan, where they're a couple of years ahead of us, a lot of older anime is starting to have a revival on mobile phones and PDAs.
I mean, that's one thing I've always thought about these little screens, that animation must work a lot better than live action, you know.
Well, the interesting thing is there's a lot of really great storytelling, particularly some of the older TV series, where you have things like the first two Gundam series, which are enormous, epic story arcs, or Legend of Galactic Heroes, which has clocked up like 120-something episodes so far and is still running, where the animation is perhaps a little bit creaky for a modern screen. You know, if you showed a 1979, 1980 animation nowadays on a modern TV screen, it would show its age. Mm. But of course, on those little tiny handheld screens, they look fantastic. And the format of being able to download little bits and watch them whenever you can deal with them actually lends itself, in the same way that manga lends itself, to people with not much time who want to just top up on their favourite serial every now and then. So it's kind of a visual manga for the West, which will be a lot of fun, I think, when it catches on over here.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Thinking, though, of the competition of sort of big screen anime with a small screen, the computer, all that, some of the films that I've seen in the cinema over the last year seem to be concentrating more on spectacle than sort of a coherent narrative. I mean, I think Satoshi Kon's Paprika achieves a lot more than, say, Mamoru Oshii's Ghost in the Shell 2, or, say, last year, Otomo's new film, Steam Boy.
Mm. Well, Steam Boy, I think, was although it's a gorgeous piece to look at, I think it was a big disappointment to some people, myself included, in terms of content, because it was all, look at me, here I am, I'm clever, I'm fast, wow, whiz, bang, what was that about? It's a wonderful piece of visual invention. It's gorgeous to look at, but it's like eating too much marshmallow at a sitting, really, isn't it? you sort of look at it and you think, well, that was nice, but now I'd like something solid. And as you say, Paprika, ultimately, Kon's work is more satisfying because there's more humanity in it, I think. Mm. Which is not to deny Otomo's enormous gifts, but for some reason, he seems to have more difficulty translating that into film than Kon does. Perhaps because he's so influential and so powerful that I'm sure that trying to get him to edit himself is quite a challenge for any studio. I mean, in a way, that's kind of true of Miyazaki, in that he's created an instrument that can make whatever film he wants. But he's such a craftsman in just about every field of animation.
Yeah.
He's done almost every job except writing music. In fact, I think he has done every job except writing music and photography. So he understands how you edit. He's a filmmaker's filmmaker. Whereas I think Otomo, who's done so much of his best work in manga, understanding how you edit is a totally different challenge.
And ironically, though, Kon sort of started off as one of Otomo's protégés, working on Rujin Z, World Department Horror and Memories.
Yeah, and I think one of the great things that one has to say for Otomo is he has always been very good at promoting talent and very generous about acknowledging talent. And one of my big beefs, actually, with the British version of manga, Akira, is that they cut out the final page of the Japanese version in which Otomo pays the most wonderful, touching tribute to Osamu Tezuka.
Huh.
And says, you know, essentially that Tezuka was his inspiration.
Mm.
And Akira is a direct tribute to Tezuka. That was cut out of the American version, and therefore the British version. Presumably because people thought, well, who's going to have heard of this Tezuka guy?
Yeah. And Otomo wrote the screenplay for Metropolis, which was based on...
Yeah, Tezuka. Although just about everybody who was anybody in the industry was kind of queuing up to be involved in that.
Right.
And it is such a wonderful film.
I mean, it's my absolute favourite.
I've got to admit, gorgeous as it is, the best thing about Metropolis is the score.
Mm.
I mean, that score is just, fantastic.
Thinking of Metropolis, when it's the end of the world, they play a gospel song by Ray Charles, which is brilliant,
yeah.
You know.
Which works.
Yeah.
it is quite strange, actually. You still talk to people, I mean, I still talk to quite a lot of people who say, oh, that Japanese animation stuff, either it's Pokemon, isn't it, just for little kids, or it's all that violent stuff that they go on about on telly, isn't it? And when you sort of say to them, well, actually, no, it's kind of samurai romances, and it's history, and it's school stories, and it's beautiful music, and it's astounding art, and yes, a lot of rubbish, because TV is basically about purveying rubbish to the greatest number of people.
Mm.
But the highs are so stunningly high that it can stand with any visual art form in the world. And yet, you know, still there's this very narrow window of perception. It's growing all the time, but we have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing to open those shutters and let out more of what anime really is about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was shocked, actually, a few months ago when the South Bank show did a program on anime and 60% of it seemed to be on manga. It's like, well, you could have done a show on manga, you know.
Yep, exactly.
Just thinking, going back to the film that you're showing at the end of this month, it does seem to resemble, in a lot of ways, Ghost in the Shell 2 Innocence. But I found that film almost entirely incomprehensible, while Paprika actually seems to be following in the tradition of things like Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and Alice in Wonderland and other sort of dreamscape movies.
Mm. And there are quite a lot of elements in anime that Paprika draws on quite strongly. He's a literate visual artist, he's a literate film artist, but he's not ashamed of his origins. He knows his anime, and he's quite happy to use that and use as many different references as he can, knowing that it will work on different levels for different audiences.
Mm.
You are going to see a film which is as good as any live-action film you're likely to see, by a director who has all the skills that he would need to make blockbusters with live actors. He chooses to work in animation because that gives him more control over the dreamscape, the internal life of his movies. But you're not going to see anything that is in any way less than a live-action movie. You're going to see a proper movie, but that just happens to have the actors drawn rather than shot on film. And you're also going to see something that's very human, very witty, very warm, very funny, very realistic, by a man who understands modern urban life and puts in there everything he can think of about coping with it. We've sold out every show so far.
Oh, fantastic.
And I've been really thrilled about it, but do get people to book early. We are already talking about another season next year, another 9 starting in October.
Okay.
And if anybody's got any topics that they'd find particularly interesting or any films they'd like to tackle, and you didn't mind passing on emails to me, I'd be delighted to have them.
Yeah, certainly, will do.
Unfortunately, the screening of Paprika on the 29th is sold out, though there may be returns on the night. But there is an Animate the World season starting the following month, which includes a screening of Miyuki Miyabi's Brave Story and films from countries as diverse as Finland, Estonia and Argentina. In the meantime, if you'd like to make suggestions for which films or TV anime shows the Barbican might show in the autumn and beyond, please leave a comment on www.readyformyclosesup.com. www.blogspot.com, where you'll also be able to download the podcast of tonight's show. If you'd like to know more about the subject, there are various links on the blog, plus in all good bookshops any day now, you'll be able to buy a revised version of Helen's book, The Anime Encyclopedia, which gives a précis and starting point for every aspect of the genre. I'm ready for my close-up. We'll be back at the same time next week.